my dad was sort. I think he fancied himself sort of a cult leader. Tried to start a commune up in northern Minnesota, and tried to, by the force of his will, which was significant, generate intentional community. He could kind of keep it hanging together as long as he was exerting the force of his will on it. But it didn't take long if he let his attention go elsewhere for it to sort of decay. And so I really, I'm not big on the notion of leaders to start with, and I think that, until people can just sort of figure out how to coexist without being directed to coexist, it's going to be kind of a futile endeavor.
So hello, everybody. This is Ryan Orok, and I'm honored today to be speaking with Sam Dodge. Welcome, Sam.
Hi, Ryan.
And Sam is such a fascinating guy, and the example that I can give you today, when you read this, it just makes you want to know more, and that's his posting from today. He wrote, and is it okay if I read this, Sam?
Absolutely.
Okay, he said, "I can tell you beautiful stories. You can fall into my words as a diver into a pond, or you might recoil from my words, finding them to be vile and insulting. Or you might just think what I say is pointless and stupid. Yet you don't necessarily have any idea who I am. When we're looking into each other's eyes, when we let the words fall away, like so much confetti in colored light, perhaps we can swim in each other's waters and actually come to know each other a little better." Wow. Beautiful. So, where did that come from?
I think I was driving back from, the stuff goes through my head and I try to formulate it into something that makes sense to me and then present it. And I think a lot about how people can get to know each other. I think that so much of modern life is dedicated to us insulating from each other. And so a lot of what I ponder is kind of the opposite of that, trying to find ways to uninsulate, you know?
So, yeah, I think our separation from one another, the concept of separation, has led to everything from environmental destruction to sweatshops in third world countries. I agree with you profoundly on that. So how do we and how do we help other people to move towards that connection, aside from the beautiful poetry and the things you're writing?
I think the biggest thing we can do is just try to set an example, try to be, you know, as open as we can in whatever circumstance we find ourselves.
Now, where do you live now?
I'm out in the middle of nowhere in western Wisconsin, about 80 miles from Minneapolis, St. Paul.
And is this where you're from originally?
I'm originally from Minneapolis, St. Paul.
All right. So you and wolves and bears and not much else out there?
We've actually got a pretty good little community out here. There are a lot of folks that either have lived here all their lives or moved here who are interested in getting a little closer to the notion of, you know, a functional community in which the people are actually sharing a lot of the aspects of daily life. And as counterintuitive as it might seem to move away from a population center to get to know people better, we've fallen into a pretty nice group of people here that we get together with on a pretty regular basis and share a lot of mundane stuff as well as a lot of good, deep friendship.
What are some examples of how you share that community with these people?
Well, there's one place we could start. There's actually a group called the Hay River Transition Initiative. You've probably heard of Transition Towns and the Transition Initiative.
For those who haven't heard anything about it, can you fill us in a bit?
It's a group that's dedicated to forming resilient, functional community. And I guess the main push is towards the notion that we aren't going to be able to be living this petroleum-generated high life for a whole lot longer. And there are going to be a lot of things that we're going to need to be able to do with each other on a local basis to make community possible. This isn't like the spearhead of my life at this point or anything, but it's an example of how a lot of the folks around here are getting together, sharing information. We have seminars where we get together and share like green living skills. Like I taught a bunch of people how to graft fruit trees this spring. There were folks there that had a lot of good information about passive solar, active solar, the use of water, finding mushrooms. Everybody just gets together and educates each other on the things that we could all be doing out here in terms of living a little bit closer to the land and with less damage to the earth. So that's an example of where our community has been going.
So it's an education initiative. Is the children's education different than normal?
Well, as the community goes, there are a few members of our community that are homeschoolers, and we were homeschoolers, although three of our kids decided to do a little bit of public school. Our son, who's now graduating from college, or just graduated from, got his bachelor's from a school in the Twin Cities, was homeschooled except for 1 year. And then our two youngest decided that they wanted to go to public school starting in like ninth grade. But mostly they're homeschooled. And the difference in education, that's probably an interview in and of itself, but it's a lot about learning critical thinking rather than memorizing facts. It's a lot about opening yourself up to your environment rather than regimenting, as most public schools tend to do.
Now, is there any connection financially between the people in the HRTI? And let me just give that URL while we're here. It's HayRiverTI.org, if people want to look at that. Is it mostly an educational thing, or do you pool finances or anything?
There hasn't been a great deal of pooling of finances, although there is a listserv where everybody can communicate via email. You know, you can put out an email to the entire group, which at this point is about 150 email addresses, I think, about some services you may have to offer or something you might need or something you may know about that's going on. For instance, it's been heavily used recently to get people up to speed on what our community is doing to fight against frac sand mining companies that have been moving into our area. We've got real nice uniform little sand here that's very useful to the natural gas and oil fracking industry, and we're trying to sort of cast them out. And we've used the email listserv for that. But all kinds of things. I mean, we tell each other that we're having a party Friday night, and we all get together and, you know, grill and talk about this and that. And it's just a fun community. We get some stuff done.
Now, compared to what you do on Facebook, can you contrast what you use Facebook for? Because you seem rather active on Facebook compared to like this email listserv or the local people around you.
Well, to be perfectly honest, at this point, Facebook for me is more of a distraction than anything else.
Okay.
And I can sort of rationalize my little addiction to it by pretending that I'm putting out some fun information and some poetry and some personal feelings about things. But I do like to think that some of the things I present, if you go to my photos, if you read some of the things that I've posted there, I've actually tried to do little information sessions on Facebook as well as just bandy philosophy.
What kind of info sessions?
Well, I I try to give people the heads up in the area here on Facebook. Some of my Facebook friends are local. On when I've found things like morel mushrooms or wild asparagus, or when the wild shallots are up and around, and I post pictures of me going out and finding them, showing what they look like and where I find them and things like that. I posted a series of photographs on grafting fruit trees, and just a general kind of picture of what we're doing here, to give an idea of what sort of life we're leading and how it makes me feel to be living this life. And that's, like I said, I think I may have mentioned that sort of modeling, the sort of life that you think might be a good life is probably the best way, in my opinion, of promoting it.
So, I mean, I guess that on one side it could be advertising, come live here, this is what we're doing, and then on the other side it's you could do this too, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
All right, well, we've got all sorts of interesting topics opened up. So, and I've got a bunch of questions written down already that sort of jump all over the place. And
okay.
I hope you and everyone else forgives it. But about the homeschooling, before I forget. Excuse me. A lot of people think, okay, homeschooling, that sounds like a lot of work, or how am I supposed to be able to replace, you know, 10 teachers for my kid or whatever. What are the challenges in homeschooling? What's your philosophy about it? What are some positive experiences?
Well, the challenges of homeschooling is, I think the biggest challenge of homeschooling is being able to present yourself as a parent as kind of an overall authority on what the kid needs to learn.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, obviously, I think actually it's also one of the assets as well, because the kid's going to come back to you and say, you're not a math teacher, you're not a physics teacher, you're not a geometry teacher, you're not a historian, you know, how can you be teaching me this? And the thing is, for me, possibly the only fields that raise a difficulty in that department would be like math and the formal rules of language, but that stuff's all available. So and again, really what we're not, I may have mentioned this earlier, you're really not trying to, in my opinion, teach the children, fill their heads with facts or even methodology necessarily. What you're doing, what I feel like you do as a homeschooler, is present them with a notion that they have the ability to find the information they need.
Uh-huh.
In other words, you're not learning things necessarily, but you're learning to learn. There it's more about just opening up their innate ability to perceive and register, which I think public school often tends to run in the exact opposite direction. So I don't know if I answered your whole question there.
Compare your kids to public school kids through the homeschooling experience. Can you give us some examples of how they're better problem solvers or what you've seen as a difference socially?
Socially, our kids tend to, when they go into a situation of their peers or when they've gone into public school, they tend to be the activators. They tend to be the kids that start things up. When Devin went, he went for ninth grade, and then he came home. He wanted to play football. Prairie Farm, which is the town that my kids go to school at when they go, their public school is real clicky. The kids don't really, or they didn't really, interact across grade lines. You know, seventh graders hang with seventh graders and ninth graders hang with ninth graders and blah, blah, blah. And Devin didn't really understand that very well when he went to school. This is an example.
Mm-hmm.
So when he got there, he was talking to kids the school there is K through 12.
Oh,
and he was talking to kindergarten. He was talking to kids in 12th grade. He was talking to the teachers. He was connecting with everybody. And it wasn't too long before the instructors were starting to give us little cues like, you know, we're so happy that Devin is here. We haven't had this much class participation ever before.
Hmm.
So that would be a contrast. That would be contrasting the sort of the. And I don't know that that would necessarily relate to homeschooling in general. But we're kind of a personality family here. and I guess maybe that comes across in the public eye as well. So if you're maybe pointing out that maybe some homeschooling might be perceived as sort of limiting the ability to interact with other kids, that may be true of some homeschoolers, but in our case, it didn't seem to work that way.
Well, if you think about it, it's really kind of a strange environment to put all the kids together who are just in a certain age level. And, I mean, I never went to a K through 12 school. I had elementary and then junior high and high school. But basically, you're around people who are all sort of the same age. You're not connecting to a lot of much older or much younger. The only place I had that was in my church experience. And so you maybe that's why some kids are not used to talking to kids who are 4 years older or 4 years younger, but that's an unfortunate thing if they're not.
Yeah.
Okay, so your kids are mixing it up at the school. Can I ask your professional background?
Pretty varied. I've done most of my experience has been in construction related trades. I spent 4 years in the Navy back in the early 80s. But aside from that, I've been a house painter, a builder, a roofer. I've done siding. I spent about 8 years building sets and props for movies and commercials and music videos and things like that in there.
Wisconsin? So mostly,
I was in the Twin Cities then.
Oh, okay. All right. Uh-huh.
So mostly working with my hands, building stuff.
Cool. I had another question relating to the community, and that was this frac sand mining. How do you stop a giant multinational company from having their way with your community and its land?
Well, that's another extensive topic, but it's. Right now, when I'm looking at what's been going on here, it's sort of a choice between being beholden to the corporation or being beholden to the corporate government. The way at this point to kind of keep some sort of reins on the corporations is to get your township zoned, as in having a development plan for the township, which means, you know, subjecting the entire community to whatever laws you might want to have the sand companies subjected to, plus some other ones, because a township is a really small thing. It's a lot of times 1/100th of a county. And so the legal aspects of trying to build your own township zoning policy is we don't even have enough money to keep the roads in the sort of condition that, you know, you could drive on, much less hire some lawyers and set up a set of regulations that would meet with approval. So what you generally have to do is adopt county zoning. And that tends to sort of keep the wolves at bay at this point. And our township, I believe, is adopting zoning, and all of a sudden the sand mining companies are finding that, oh, our sand is too fine, or it's too far from a rail spur or something like that, and they're kind of where they had been going to dig a mine, they have now decided they're not going to for the time being.
So it's kind of playing the two devils of state and corporation against each other for the moment, yeah?
For the moment, yeah, that would be the picture I'm seeing.
Hmm. And how do you feel about that? Is that the way to do it, or if it works good enough, or?
I don't think there is a way to do it, personally. Until a lot more people realize that they spend their lives servicing the corporations, there is not going to be much in the way of stopping the corporations.
So you're waiting, in some sense, for people to wake up, yeah?
Sure, yeah. And I'm not, I guess probably waiting might not even be the right word. I'm just going to try to, and I'm sitting here with my electric computer in my house, and we cook with a lot of times with a propane type stove, and so we aren't divorced from it either. But the idea is to service that social dynamic at the lowest possible level, and we're trying to move that direction as much as we can.
Well, what do you mean? Go ahead.
Try to, at this point, what I can say is that, you know, we may be looking at this whole thing as, oh, we've got this energy crisis, right?
Uh-huh.
Energy crisis is not oil, and it's not electricity, and it's not nuclear, it's not any of these things. The crisis is that the actual energy that these big companies, that these money people deal in, is human energy. And everybody, all the humans, or the great majority of the humans, are pouring their energy into this system. And that's why the system is able to dominate the culture. And so until people realize that it's their energy that's actually driving the system is going to dominate.
So it's like we're all in that big matrix where the batteries right now, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely.
And we're running the machines that we're, on some level, trying to stop on another level, yeah?
Yeah.
I love the comparison. So what's your attitude towards government, politics, things like that?
That's a tough one. you know, ideally, people wouldn't need to be told what to do. And I don't think anybody who would really sat down and thought about it for any great length of time could argue the fact that each of us has sort of an ethical compass.
Uh-huh.
That we could follow if we wanted to, that would create harmony between ourselves and any other entity that we interacted with. But for any number of reasons in the human psyche, we're not quite willing to do that, and we're not quite willing to trust the other to do that. But that's what's going to have to happen, and you can't legislate that, and you can't make an edict saying, okay, you have to trust everybody. You have to work with everybody. And you can't have policemen telling people that you have to trust everybody and you have to work with everybody, because you've just defeated the whole concept at that point.
Like enforcing love,
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, I don't know how it's going to come about, or if it is going to come about. But at this point in my life, I'm just going to do my best to see it come about as much as possible for me and those people that I'm going to interact with.
This reminds me of the film K-Pax. Kevin Spacey says, they talk about this topic, well, what about governments? And And he turns and he looks at Jeff Bridges, who's playing the psychologist. He's trying to figure out if Kevin Spacey is really an alien or he's just a psychotic. And he says, every being in the universe knows right from wrong, Mark.
And yeah.
It's like a crazy idea for him that we would have to be told what's right or forced to do what's right, you know?
Yeah.
Right. Well, and Kate, you know what? I think people's attitudes towards government a lot of times are very connected to their attitude towards children and then also their religious attitudes. So if I was going to say, okay, I'm expecting my first child, which I'm not, but if I were, or someone I know is, and I was going to say, Sam, how do I raise children best? What can you give me about tips? What's your attitude towards that?
Well, again, that's kind of a tough one. Am I going to try to offer this child the universal ideal? Am I going to prepare them pragmatically for what they're actually going to enter into? It's a dilemma.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you've got to prepare them for both as much as you can, and you know, so maybe the boat doesn't sink entirely. Maybe it floats halfway for the time being. I don't see that we're going to have this. I don't see that everybody's going to suddenly raise their children to be ideal citizens of the universe. If it happens, it'll happen bit by bit, or you know, maybe some great cataclysm. I have no idea. But at this point, I don't think there is a silver bullet. But you're right. The kids are really the important thing. They're the next ones coming up, and so you've got to prepare them for what they're entering into, but you've got to give them as much as you can of the notion that you trust them. That's the starting point. I think we're modeling trust, whether it's to our children or to other people. We're modeling an openness, a sort of a surrender to each other as much as we can. And we have to hope that that we're giving the kids enough of each thing. Obviously, we have to give them some defense mechanisms, as harsh as that kind of seems, along with the notion of what beauty could be.
So explain that to me, the universal ideal versus pragmatism. What do you mean exactly, or can you give some examples?
Well, here I am out on this little farm, mm-hmm. and I've got these four lovely children, and I'm going to raise them to be flower children running around in the field, loving the universe and loving every person they meet and trusting every person they meet. And that is just a glorious picture. I think it's a glorious picture.
Mm-hmm.
But then what do I do? Do I keep them here on the farm? Do I let them wander off into Minneapolis, St. Paul and trust that they're wide open, and assuming that I've been able to even give them, with my own, indoctrinations throughout my life, assuming that I'm even able to give them this sort of pure beauty of love and innocence that kind of would be the ideal, I guess. Are they going to survive if they leave this sort of nest that's been created for them?
How do you handle acting up? How do you handle punishment with your children?
Oh, a number of ways, and not always well.
Okay.
I'm a human being. None of my kids were in jeopardy of having shaken baby syndrome or anything like that. But I've yelled at them. And I've yelled at them consciously and purposefully sometimes.
Sometimes you have to say, don't touch that, it's hot, right?
Or sometimes I will be trying to model the behavior of someone that they might meet out there that wasn't their daddy. you know, that wasn't their mommy, that they might do something that would actually make somebody really angry, and then they would have to face sort of that blast from a person that they didn't know wasn't going to hurt them, you know?
So do you caution them then? You say, okay, now I'm going to be a mean guy.
No, it's not like that.
We're going to practice out there.
Just give them a halfway, you know, I'll just unleash. I'm not going to give them the big red-faced spitting, what the bleepity bleep did you think you were doing there? I want to kick your rear end and throw you down the stairs or whatever kind of reaction they might get out in the real world if they, you know, did something seriously naughty. But more often it's just, you know, what, just sitting down with them and trying to sort of reason out what they may have just done if it was what I consider to be misbehavior, and what do they think would happen, you know, what would be the result of their actions in a given situation.
So sort of discussing it almost as equals rather
as much as possible. Yeah, every now and then you've got to just say, because I'm your dad. But mostly you try and, you know, spark their minds about what they, you know, what were they thinking when they did it, and what they think would happen if they did that. You know, what if you did set the couch on fire? You know?
Well, you know, I've learned that everyone is trying to meet some need with every action.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the strategies are effective and some of the strategies are not effective. So it sounds like if you're encouraging them to have consciousness about why they did things, that's the best way to find the most effective strategy to meet everybody's needs. It's kind of the terminology I use.
Yeah, that's fair, yeah.
So I want to ask a bit, what's if you're comfortable talking about it, what's your spiritual path or religion, maybe historically as well as now?
I was raised with religion as an option.
Uh-huh.
To sort of set the stage, my dad was raised Catholic. He went to Catholic school with nuns and things like that for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And my mom was raised Jewish.
Mm.
And so when my mom and dad came together, neither one of them were staunch believers in their religion to start with, or they probably wouldn't have gotten together anyway, because that was the late '50s, and it was sort of a, it was like two races.
Oil and water, yeah.
Yeah. My folks, neither one of them went to church, neither one of them practiced a religion. Sometimes when I would go to my grandparents' place, especially my Catholic grandparents' place, I would go to church with them as a kid. When I had friends that were involved in some formal religion, my folks didn't have any problem if I wanted to go to Sunday school with them or whatever. So I was really raised basically just to explore it on my own. And I kind of still feel like that's my path.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't raise our children with any particular theology. We tried to expose them to as many theologies as we could.
Not a lot of ritual then that you incorporate into the family, or
no? We don't do Christmas. We don't do Easter. We don't do Kwanzaa, we don't do, you know, Rosh Hashanah.
No presents, no tree, no nothing, yeah?
Well, we do have presents. What we've done...
Okay.
what we did, because, you know, our kids would look at everybody and their Christmas tree and their Christmas lights and their shiny new bicycle and all that fun stuff. And we decided we'd try and create some sort of a more pragmatic holiday. And so we do what we call a winter celebration, which through the years of their childhood generally lasted a week or 10 days. And for successive days, everybody in the family would pick a country. And they would study up a little bit on the customs, the rituals, the climate, the geography, the language of the country that they wanted to celebrate. And that would be their day, and they would be partially responsible for cooking some food that may have been, historically a food of that place. We'd learn a little bit about whatever religion was present in that country, be it Hindu or Muslim or Christian or pagan or whatever it might be. So we would have this like week-long celebration where everybody got to go to the country of their choice at home. And we would open presents each day. We would just buy each other some gifts and make sure everybody had some little thing to open up most days of the celebration.
Sounds like a fun idea.
And it gives, you know, it gave them an opportunity to sort of learn a few words of whatever language from whatever place they went to, and a little bit about the world and a little bit about, you know, the various religions of the world. For me, I don't consider myself to be a religious person. I do consider myself to be sort of a spiritual person. I mean, I think that when you look around at what we're in the middle of here, it's pretty miraculous. Whether it happened accidentally or on purpose or however it may have happened,
right?
It's pretty amazing, and to be part of that is it. You know, if you just let it sort of, if you let yourself immerse in it, it's a spiritual experience to even walk out in the woods.
Hmm. Do you have any springtime rituals?
Not in particular. We've done Beltane and Samhain celebrations around here with other community members.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we generally have a pretty decent Samhain celebration with the burning of a corn king and people, you know, casting wishes into the fire and fun stuff like that. It's been, I think everything around here for us has been more earth-based than anything else. Just sort of a celebration of the bounty of this life.
Now, you seem to strike me, you talk about, grafting fruit trees and things like this. What kind of connection do you have to the land, both past and now?
Well, when I was about 9 years old, my folks decided to try and start a subsistence community on some land up in northern Minnesota, live off the land, garden, have animals, live without electricity, live without, you know, running water, cut firewood, either hunt or raise our own meat and our own beets and our own corn and tomatoes and all that sort of thing. So from a fairly early age, I've been exposed to a subsistence lifestyle. And I moved away from that for a while. Sort of when I flew the nest, I joined the Navy and ended up in California for 4 years and met my wife. And then when we moved back to Minnesota, which is where I started out. We ended up in the city for a while, but then we ended up out here on a piece of land because I've always wanted to get back to that, being more more in touch with the dirt, more coexistent with the earth I'm living on. And so I took what I had learned as a kid and what we had learned gardening in St. Paul and brought it here. And I've just, it's just been a continuous process for me of trying to get with the cycles of the planet and get with the notion of whatever it may be, permaculture or foraging, or however I can get closest to sort of being a staunch citizen of the planet.
So can you give me a bit of a picture of what it looks like at your farm? Is it permaculture? Oh. Do you have animals? What's the setup?
It's a mess. It's always a mess. It's always in a state of transition. All the buildings that I've made here have been made out of recycled materials. We've got a little orchard up on the hill that I tried to put a fence on with some fast-growing trees around here, and they've rotted. And so I've gathered up old rusty wire and made little cages around the trees. But we've got about 50 fruit trees in various stages of maturity. We've got about maybe 200 by 300 feet of annual garden for tomatoes and potatoes and beets and carrots and squash and all the, things like that. We've got a summer kitchen outside with a wood cook stove in it that we do all of our canning on. We can a lot of our food for the winter. We're on 100 acres of Wisconsin hills. That's about half fields that we're letting go back to trees mostly, and half woods where we gather our firewood and I go foraging for wild food and hunting and whatnot.
No animals?
At the moment, no. My wife and the remaining children here, well, we have Shelties and Border Collie Sheltie mixes that they have a little sort of cottage industry of raising and selling a few puppies a couple times a year. But we've had chickens, and then we had a mink. We also had ducks at that time. And the mink took out our flock of chickens and our ducks, and over the course of about 3 days, we lost 35 chickens and 25 ducks. And we haven't quite gotten up the heart to start another flock. We haven't been. We do get our chickens from a person locally who grows them, and I trade like maple syrup for birds or work for them. We try to do a similar thing with beef. We have a neighbor who raises clean organic grass-fed beef, and we get our meat from him, our beef from him, and we usually contract for a pig or two every year from another local person.
So tell me about maple syrup. I have only ever eaten maple syrup in the bottle. I've never seen it like produced. Is that a very intensive job? I think it takes a lot of energy, right?
Yeah, it's energy intense. It's an energy intensive process. It's a flash in the spring, in the early spring. Usually, it's about a month of going out in the woods and putting taps in and collecting sap, and then cooking the sap down to syrup. And then if you've done well, you've got a pretty good supply of sugar. If you're willing to put 3 weeks or a month of the doldrums of a Wisconsin winter, when it's all slush and you can't do any construction work, and for me, I don't have a formal job, and it's not a time when I get a lot of work. So I have the luxury of putting 3 weeks or a month into just being out in the woods, tapping trees, gathering sap, bringing it back to the cooking station and cooking it down. And I actually have a friend not too far from here who has a really big, what we call a sugar bush, which is a stand of maple trees. We've got about 2,700 taps that we put in maple trees every spring.
Really? So yeah. That's not, when you say 3 weeks, that's not an hour here and an hour there. That's like full time for 3 or 4 weeks, yeah?
Yeah, it's full time for 3 or 4 weeks. And he's also got a large maple syrup evaporator that's run on wood that's generally harvested from dead wood in the area, and we burn wood to cook the syrup down, or the sap down to syrup. Takes about 40 gallons of sap to make 1 gallon of syrup. And on a good year, those 2,700 trees will produce about 800 or 1,000 gallons of syrup.
So you're carrying around 40,000 gallons of sap to get that 1,000 gallons of syrup.
Yeah, he's running a system of lines, of little hoses off of his trees. So it's run by gravity, and he also uses old milking vacuum pumps to help bring the sap down the lines to large bulk tanks where we collect it and bring it back to the evaporator.
Okay, so you're not carrying buckets through the woods all day.
No, it's not quite that rustic. We've done that here at home. We've made our own syrup here at home that way, and on a good year we'll produce 10 or 15 gallons of syrup that way. But we haven't been doing that so much since I've been doing the big sugar bush thing with my buddy Steve.
Well, I want to try that someday. I want to see how that's done. I guess it tastes completely different than what you buy in the store, right?
Well, sometimes it will taste completely different from what you buy in the store, and sometimes it'll probably taste a lot like it, because their process, if they're actually producing maple syrup, isn't really significantly different from what we do. So, you know, and I don't know. I mean, what part of the country are you in?
Right now, Las Vegas.
Okay, so yeah, there aren't too many maple trees to tap.
No.
So yeah, the process is pretty much the same for everybody. They go and make a little hole in the tree and put a little tap in it and either collect the sap into buckets or down lines into large collection tanks, and then they cook it until it's mostly sugar. And then it's nice thick syrup, and depending on how much time it has to spend on the heat and the quality of the sap, you get either a really light colored sort of what they call a grade A syrup, all the way down to something that we produced this year, which was just a horrible year for syrup, what we call a maple molasses, which goes beyond the commercial grade to like this very molassesy stuff, which isn't really that great on pancakes, but makes a really good barbecue sauce, and actually to replace the sweetener in, say, a pumpkin pie, it's pretty good. So yeah, there's a lot of different flavors of maple syrup, and most of that is dependent on how much sugar content was initially in the sap, because the lower the sugar content, the longer it has to cook, the more it's going to darken, and the more of the other things besides the sugar are going to be concentrated in the syrup.
And that just depends on weather, what that is each year.
Yep.
Huh, interesting. Now, when you say you're constructing from recycled materials, how are you building things? What are you building?
We've got a lot of rustic outbuildings here that are mostly made out of lumber from reclaimed barns and outbuildings, and corrugated galvanized metal for roofing and siding on a lot of them, because that's a really an abundant resource around here. Buildings falling down, old farms falling down, because little old farms are not very popular things to try to maintain.
Are people moving towards the cities a lot then in Wisconsin?
I think so. The population of our local little towns around here hasn't changed a great deal. But a lot of what's occurring is the farmsteads are getting larger and more corporate, and more the labor on the farmsteads is being accomplished not as much by the local small farmer that might have lived there, but by migrant labor as much as anything.
Mm-hmm.
So very similar to most other places in the country. I'm sure that you see a lot of that in Las Vegas and wherever else you might have lived.
Right.
The actual hands-on work that's being done is not being done so much by Joe Beer, you might say,
right.
Mr. Bridge. It's being done by folks that are willing to work for a lot less than John Q. Public wants to work for.
Where do you get your news and information about the world, primarily?
Through word of mouth, through the internet.
Particular sites?
I suppose Facebook is pretty big in that.
Right, no, me too. Uh-huh.
One of my real good friends around here actually is the editor for our local paper, and he's very, very concerned about world politics, and so he talks a lot about it when we're hanging out together, and a lot of the folks around here do that. I'm not as absorbed by world politics as a lot of people are. I realize that there isn't a huge amount that I can really do about even what might be going on in Las Vegas.
Right.
As much as I can build relationships right here where I am. And of course, you know, I have a lot of fun building these Facebook relationships. But in terms of how it's going to how that's going to play out with my own pragmatic life, who knows?
I was going to ask, has the Occupy movement at all reached your neck of the woods, or is there anything going on there? And then what's your take on it?
We live about 75 miles from the Twin Cities, so there's been some enthusiasm in this area. There have been some folks from this actual local area that, especially because living in Wisconsin, you've been hearing Wisconsin news about Scott Walker and this and that. We had pretty good turnouts in Madison. And places like that in disgust and revulsion at what our corporate governor has been trying to do to the state. So a lot of people from here actually have gone and occupied Madison or gone and occupied Minneapolis. And I guess I'm not really in a great position not having... I've been to a couple of rallies. I went to a rally up in Rice Lake.
Mm-hmm.
It was nice to see a lot of people energized. And participating in something.
Right.
I think that when I look at the Occupy movement, I think that the peripheral... benefits in that these are people that actually learned how to work together. A lot of times, you see a lot of this stuff where it took a while to actually sort of develop a kind of infrastructure for hanging out in a town square. How do you get fed?
Right.
And how bad are you going to stand there and smell for 3 weeks at a time or whatever, So I think that to me, the biggest benefit of these movements has been that the people who are participating in them are actually learning how to operate together.
Mm-hmm.
without being told to operate together. And at a certain point, I mean, you see it and you get a lot of the sort of call and response stuff that was going on at a lot of these rallies.
Mm-hmm.
And people are being directed what to do and they're doing it. Right? Like the what did they call it? The human megaphone?
Right.
It's cool, but it's just another example of authority to me.
Uh-huh.
So you have to watch out for that, in my opinion. But like I said, I think the benefits have not necessarily been that our corporations and our government got a big warning from the people, because it obviously is nowhere near enough to even begin to make them think that they might want to change their plans about anything. But the people who participated learned how to operate together a little better.
Right. And it's something we don't practice too terribly much, so I see that also as a very useful thing. Have your kids been involved in any of this at all, if they're at college or whatever?
Yeah, I think my son has participated in some of that sort of thing. He goes to a Lutheran liberal arts college, and this college is very, very active in the community and very active in the world. So he's been immersed in a lot of that, in a lot of community activism from that perspective. Let's see. I know that our girls who are in high school actually were part of a walkout at the Prairie Farm High School when Scott Walker declared that he wanted to take away collective bargaining rights from government employees. So the kids actually, they were part of a walkout at school in support of the teachers.
Totally different topic, but your microphone sounds really good. What kind of mic do you have?
It's a little Microsoft. It's on the camera.
It's the camera mic, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
I don't even know what the brand is. It was about a $45 dealio. But yeah, it's pretty good.
Okay, so any final words or messages for potentially all of society and the universe that has the internet?
Well, have fun on the internet. Learn what you can. Get out there and practice whatever it is that you believe. It's a lot of fun to hang out and yak about it on the screen, but I'll tell you what, for me, there's nothing like being out there playing in the dirt or out there walking in the woods, finding mushrooms or out dancing around a fire with people, you know, actually doing the stuff that we're dreaming about as much as possible. And to me, and I've got a long ways to go on this myself, the best thing we can do if we are thinking about defeating a broken social paradigm here, you know, the whole corporate world takeover here, is not to go and try and tell the corporation that they're screwing up, but to show as many people as possible what an actual good lifestyle looks like. And just take it from there.
I think the big message from you is be the example. Do it how you think it should be done.
Yeah, because no one should be... I don't think anybody has the right or the authority to direct anybody else. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how do you go out there and tell people that they're screwing up, right? It's more about me finding a way to believe that I'm doing as well as I can. And we can share. We can share information. But I don't want to be responsible for your behavior, you know?
Yeah, and if you knew me better, you'd want to be even less responsible.
And I don't want you to be responsible for mine, on the other hand, either, so...
Right. Okay, well, then I will wrap it up here.
All right.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
I'm honored to be on your interview list.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people will be very interested to hear what you have to say who've been following you on Facebook. and may have not had the chance to talk to you in person. So thank you a lot.
Sure.
Okay, well, until next time.